Can everyone hear me okay? Awesome. Okay. Well, thank you all so much for coming out tonight to celebrate summer, even though it's been raining so much the past few days, and all things poetry with the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. Tonight, we are thrilled to host the poets Deb Bogan, Judith Bulmer, and Mike Schneider. So a little bit about myself and White Whale very quickly. My name is Ari. I'm the events coordinator here at White Whale, and we are a family-owned, general-interest, independent bookstore here in Pittsburgh's Bloomfield neighborhood. Our motto is conversation, community, and culture, and we strive to be a home for book lovers. Our events programming features local, national, and international writers and translators reading, discussing, and celebrating literature of all genres for all ages. So just a few events coming up this week that we think you might be interested in. This Thursday, June 29th, we'll be hosting Rachel Neuer to discuss her new nonfiction book, I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World, with WESA reporter Sarah Bowden. And this Saturday, July 1st, we will be doing a book launch for Monica Prince's choreo poem, Roadmap, here in the bookstore. A fun fact, a choreo poem is a choreographed series of poems to integrate performance poetry, dance, music, song, light, art, and so forth. So it should be a powerful evening for anyone like y'all who love poetry to be in attendance. And then next Wednesday, July 5th, be sure to tune in virtually to hear poets Jessa Coelho, Shanta Lee, and Sharon Suzuki Martinez read over Zoom. You can find out more about these events and others in RSVP at whitewhalebookstore.com. So just so you know, we are live streaming this event on Zoom for folks at home. So hello, folks at home. And just a few notes on protocol for this evening. We ask that you keep your mask on at all times, unless you are eating or drinking. The restrooms are located behind me, just there. But we ask if you can hold off until heading back there just till the event has concluded. But by all means, if you need to go to the restroom, go. And the last call for all drinks and snacks from our lovely barista will be immediately at the end of the event. We ask that you refrain from purchasing anything during the event just to not distract from the readers. And I'm going to say this now just to make it less awkward when it happens, but there is a lovely ice machine yonder. And that cafe sink will gurgle for about 60 seconds sometime during the event. And it will be from left field. We won't know when it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And it's going to be great. So now you know. We also have several copies of our writer's books for sale here. So please feel free to get those, get them signed at the end of the night, and feel free to browse our entire stock. Your support for the store is what makes free events like this possible. So that's all for me now. I'll let Chris and Joan take it away.
Hi, hello there. How are you guys doing? Are you doing good, Sven? Good to hear. Hey, thanks for coming out tonight. We certainly appreciate it. Thanks to Ari. Thanks to White Whale. Thanks to everybody involved. Thanks for you coming out. Of course, thank you to Joan, my partner on this, whose coattails ride. And we'll do so until she kicks me out. Something to look forward to. Yeah, thanks so much. It's another weird rainy night, which I think Hemingway inspires a lot of. I can remember many, many rainy nights in Oakland, real washouts. But we always had a great crowd. So again, thank you guys for coming out. So tonight I'm going to admit something personal and something a little embarrassing. So I've been writing poetry since I was 15. That's not the embarrassing part. It's only mildly. But I still, after all this time, I'll be 50 next year, have no idea how it works. Like every time I sit down to attempt to write a poem, it's like I've never written a poem before in my life. It just, whatever I've learned previously just flies out of my head, and it's all a brand new thing. And that kind of mystery in the process, the not understanding, the fear and apprehension of a blank page, it's all very attractive for a very weird reason. It keeps me coming back. I don't understand it. I don't really know fully where it comes from or how it works when it's happening. But when it is actually working, it's like the best thing in the world. So tonight I thought I would consult a couple of experts in the field and share them with you. So the first little thing I'm going to read to you is by M.C. Richards. And she taught at Black Mountain College and wrote this book, Centering, some time ago. It's an amazing book. But I'm just going to read a little bit from this. Anything can be poetry that is felt as poetry. Some poets try to formulate the meanings they sense. Others try to convey the charge they feel in events by a language which keeps the power alive and the transfer of energy true. Other poets feel in language itself a special evocative power, and they utter vocabulary in a kind of incantatory trance. Language is mysterious. There's no doubt about it. The howl of the vowels, the squeaks and the yawns and prissiness, the awful whirring and chattering of beaks, walls of consonants, housing those rousing vowels, shaping, dressing, flattening, catching, mounting, junking, the gestures of mouth and throat, the tonal form, as if man were the archetypal ideogram and language the vibration of his deeds. Poetry is immense, no matter how simple it may appear. There is no need for anyone to clomp around in big shoes and say what poetry is or isn't. First, we must listen and ponder. Sometimes I think it is poetry if it resonates, because language is alive. There is no mechanics by which it may be understood. We come to know it as we do a person. A person made it, and like a person, we know it to differing degrees in different circumstances. To come to know a poem more and more thoroughly, to feel it change as we change, the transformations of poetry are organic. Everything matters. The spelling, the position on the page, the typography, the beat of the breath, the division of syllables, loudness and softness, rhythm. All these elements of form, graphic and sonorous, help to depict the experience. They are the embodiment. Appreciating poetry is probably like appreciating anything else. It means having the generosity to let a thing be what it is, the patience to come to know it, a sense of the mystery in all living things, and a joy in new experience. Okay, that was M.C. Richards. Now I'm going to have a journey. Because I'm parched. And this is Mary Oliver. This is her poem, That Little Beast. That pretty little beast, a poem, has a mind of its own. Sometimes I want it to crave apples, but it wants red meat. Sometimes I want to walk peacefully on the shore, and it wants to take off all its clothes and dive in. Sometimes I want to use small words and make them important and it starts shouting the dictionary, the opportunities. Sometimes I want to sum up and give thanks, putting things in order. And it starts dancing around the room on its four furry legs, laughing and calling me outrageous. But sometimes, when I'm thinking about you, and no doubt smiling, it sits down quietly, one paw under its chin, and just listens. That's poetry. And now, this is Joan Bauer.
Thank you, Chris. That's so great. Thank you so much. Well, we're really happy to be here tonight. We have an amazing evening of poetry for you. I just want to say, regrettably, Ace Bogus, who's a wonderful poet, lives in Charleston, West Virginia, is not able to be here tonight. But we're really hoping we can schedule him for next summer. And I will say before we begin tonight that 2 weeks from now, on July the 11th, our poets will be Chandra Alderman, Kevin Finn, Matthew Lucia, and Bart Solarsik. And we're really looking forward to having them read it. And I don't know that these folks have ever read together. I know they haven't, actually. So this will be really great, and I hope you'll come out for that. And a big thank you to everybody in Zoom land. It's really good to have you here too. So tonight, the first poet reading is Deb Bogan, whose books of poetry are Speak Now This Charm, In Case of Sudden Free Fall, Let Me Open a Swan, Landscape with Silos, Living by the Children's Cemetery, and those titles together could be a poem. And they're wonderful, wonderful titles. Deb lives in Pittsburgh, where she balances the poet's life with grassroots political responsibility and music. Please welcome Deborah Bogan.
Thanks to all of you for coming out. I'm almost tall, aren't I? I'm so excited. There you go. Okay, is this good?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So exciting to be here. I'm going to read tonight from Speak Now This Charm, but first I just echo all the thanks because we all say all the thanks. All the thanks. Thank you. And then Speak Now This Charm is my latest book, and I've been reading around town from this book. This is kind of my swan song for this little blurb part of the readings for the first book coming out. And so I'm going to just going to whip through a lot of poems tonight and see what you think. Speak Now This Charm, that phrase, is an Anglo-Saxon admonition. So if you study the Anglo-Saxon coda, there's actually a section called Speak Now This Charm. And happily enough, those lucky Anglo-Saxons had a charm for almost everything. So if your child became infected with water elf disease, then you speak now this charm. If the bees flew from your hive, speak now this charm. If someone stole your cattle and you want to get that thief, speak now this charm. And I decided that during the pandemic shutdown, it was so awful that I wanted to just write a set of charms for us, for various things that we're now facing in the world. At the same time, these poems are all written in the shape of a box. Sorry, this is so long, but then I'll stop on that. So the box poem, that shape, is the form of the poem, but also the box as an image is throughout the work in the book. And I just wanted to call that out because as I was growing up, I had two sisters, there were three girls, and I was the only one that survived to adulthood. Two of my sisters didn't make it. They had childhood diseases. And in consequence, boxes became very salient for me because it's weird to see your sisters put in boxes. So I began to see boxes everywhere during the shutdown. The TV box was suddenly way important in our life. The window box was a whole event. The walls of the rooms we were shut into was a box. So let's start with the poems. Bodies. I've been thinking about your body and the box they put it in, wondering if you're still in there, if a hand under the lip of that box might be a way of climbing in, of being in there with you. Because once we were sisters, we thought our bodies were eternal. And sweetheart, isn't that every girl's mistake? My hands ache to touch your face, to brush the bangs from your eyes. When they took you, when they closed the lid on the box, I wished that I could be a button on your blouse. Autobiography. Am I a stolid soul because my mother was a big tree standing? In memory, her body's redacted to tallness and the slow shuffle from sink to stove that was once a North Dakota folk dance. She taught me what she could, a few Bible verses and rules she learned at school. But I could never tell if that was meant as blessing or blame. Still, this poem isn't about my mother. My life's my own, the uncut movie of a thousand reckless decisions made on the run. I tell people that I'm nothing like my mother, but that's not true. I wake up every morning knowing I will always be a woman camped on both sides of a river. So I've had very positive experiences in hospitals, and I know that's unusual, but I have. And I have a great memory of being a young mother with this newborn child standing before this, you know, floor-to-ceiling window looking out on the world, where the cars were rushing and the problems were happening and everything had to be handled. But I was just in this world where I just had this baby and that was all I needed to do. And this poem is called Asylum. They've taken my scissors and dimmed the lights, leaving me here, three floors above the street. From the window, I watch the school buses releasing the children. I trace the paths of dog walkers crisscrossing the park. From here, I can spy on the street cleaners who ogle the teenage girls heading for home. So this is it. The world's now in the hands of those who still want it. People who can drink their coffee black. People who read the daily news. I'm better off here, a geranium that needs tending. Soothing nurses glide down these halls, bringing gifts of orange juice and People magazine. Already, I've learned to love the sails of their crisp white hats. Jeff. See, you're a poet, you can do this. Death. My husband asks if I would like a Viking funeral. A game we play. If I die first, if you do, when this bond is cut, we say, then laugh. And that fiery Viking ship does have appeal. But if I go first, I say, I want to be a tree. That burial thing they advertise in fancy magazines. Ashes to alder seems civilized, yes? And this is how we do it. Handling the 70s, the 80s, keeping up the gag, talking death the way you handle eggs when you make meringue, tapping the shell on the edge of the cup, creating a separation, the yolk from the white, then whipping the one into an airy castle, so light and unlikely. There's a terrific Serbian poet you may or may not know named Vasco Popa, and he wrote a whole book called The Little Box. He didn't write in box form, but he wrote with the box as a character, and he was a great inspiration to me working through this book. So this poem is called Devotion for Vasco Popa. He loved the box. I tell you, no one loved the box like Popa. Let the box live in you, he told me. Let it sing your song with its wooden tongue. Because the box is a marvel. It's filled with gifts as sweet as raisins, gifts as charming as a postcard from Ghent. But the box, Popa warned, is still difficult. To see what it holds, you must empty its emptiness. Only then will the box share its secrets, because box begets box begets box. For this reason, Popa counseled caution. Don't play with the box, he warned me. Don't invite its dangerous attentions. Remember, the box wants something. Don't give it even a tiny bite. When I can't sleep, I imagine my body as a box, as a series of boxes. I imagine my body as box cars, a train stalled in the yard, each box requiring attention and unloading. And there's a way to do this. I've read about that in magazines. Still, I cannot quiet the body's voice. If you must think of me, the body says, don't imagine me as the box your mind is. I don't have to be that haunted or hemmed in by our history. See how I breathe without thought, in and out, in and out. That's because I have a life of my own, a buoyancy that defies our circumstances. Your mind's like a late Rothko, the body says. I'm like something painted by Matisse. Those of you who have grown children, or in my case, grown grandchildren, will have been through the process this poem describes. What I do now. I get up early to investigate the needs of the day. I turn myself into a wall, a blank, a separate thing. I give up being the key that fits their locks. I embrace new strategies. Do not explain. Do not meddle. Do not bargain. Invisible rivers still flow between us, but I know they too have been granted a secret life. So I unlearn the way the one walked, the way her sister turns her head. About their hearts, I do not speak. Like apple trees, they've sunk roots into their own meadows. Therefore, joy. Also, this vague, disembodied grief. I must pack away my craving for their childish, vulgar laughter. So as citizens, we're always trying to figure out our relationship to events past and present and actually future now as well. And the Holocaust is surely one of those. And I spent time trying to do that and I failed miserably. And in the course of that, I came across a painting by Marc Chagall. It's a painting called The Falling Angel, and the dates of the painting are 1923 to 1947. So I was immediately struck by, that's a long time to revisit a painting. And through those years, that's pretty much two wars. And this poem resulted, Remembrance Day. I took the photo from the box and looked at what seemed to be a camp and six shapes near the edge of a forest. I was hunting details that told a story. Don't we all want the narrative? And those shadow-drenched shapes could be prisoners or soldiers or even small trees. As my eyes tired, the shapes seemed smudged. They wavered like smoke. Were they becoming angels? No, it wasn't that. But I think I understand now why Chagall kept reworking The Falling Angel. Versions of heaven give way to versions of hell. And then those are painted over by a personal momentary bliss. This is not, I know, the official story, but it's the truth. Sorrow-hued, this box was built to house my sister's bony limbs. The bones of the box meant to shelter hers, but by and by, even boxes decay. So the body that housed her once hot heart will lay exposed, returned to clay. The priest spoke words. A cold rain fell. All over the cemetery, other families came, bringing their children in their boxes. I listened to the wind and to the mourners, all those mothers bringing children. They were so busy praising heaven, those mothers. They sang and sang. So I sang too. The husband coughs, and Pittsburgh's surly skies respond. On TV, the weatherwoman adjusts her tiny mic. She predicts another inch, another cough. So we cancel the party, but the paper plates and party cups are still talking trash in the kitchen. Gas bills, bank statements, damp clothes in the dryer. There's a lot to do, but today I hit pause and my eyes opened. Suddenly, I could see it, the cosmic time drip, our portion eking its way through this mindless corset of days. Outside, there was a parade, six Giacometti figures, each one leaning into her own particular weather. So people like yes and no questions and black and white versions, and I think the universe is a lot messier than that. So I wrote this poem for some of my fellows who might as well think that the universe is messier than that. It's in response to me being called out as an atheist by my minister when I was in eighth grade. And it seemed to me that he was not getting the nuance of my spiritual situation. Dear universe, is this now? Are you now too? I'm up here in seat 18B. Jetting through an obsidian sky, one more poet tapping on her laptop, trying to think in the language of insight and surprise. After all these poems, after religion and children and two husbands and some pretty good therapy, you'd think I'd have nailed a few things down. But to quote my computer, this search has returned no results. So tonight, dear heavens, dear mystery, I am reduced to beseeching. O Lord of absence and dark matter, O master of quarks and these immense, uncountable stars, are we just mice in the garden? Or to put it another way, what is this place? Speak now this charm. Lastly, we are all summer grass. So it's hard to say, were you in the box? Were you a box? Did you settle into the earth or fly up to the trees? At the chapel, there was a window where I pressed my mouth to the glass to get close to you one last time. But there was no getting at you. No getting past the body fault, the broken box. No way to even place a leaf on your face. Standing by your grave, I watched the bloody sun go flat and become horizon. So I guess there's that. A certain bigness once the grief burns off. Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. That was wonderful. So good. Before I introduce the next poet, I do want to really say special thanks to Ari and, of course, to White Whale. And I always say this. I just want to remind you that this is our home now for this series. It's wonderful to be here. And that it's especially wonderful to be surrounded by so many books. Judith Vollmer's sixth book of poetry, The Sound Boat, new and selected, was the Four Lakes Prize selection for 2022 from University of Wisconsin Press. She has many honors, including the NEA Poetry Fellowship, the Brittenham, and Cleveland State University Press Prizes, finalist honors for the Patterson Prize, Amy Patterson Prize. And her poetry has appeared widely in George Review, Poetry International, Book Women's Review of Books, and elsewhere. Please, and of course, she was the longtime editor with Ed Ochester of the beloved journal 5 a.m., for which we are greatly thankful. Please welcome Judy Vollmer.
Good to be here, see so many friends. Thank you, Ari. Thank you, White Whale. All the thanks to Joan, Chris. Thanks, Deb, for a beautiful reading. I feel all the layers and veils and by and by. Since The Sound Boat is a new and selected, it's been hard for me to figure out what to read from it. Some of the poems are 40 years old. Some of them I've read many times in Pittsburgh. And last year, I had two launches, one virtual last spring and one here at White Whale in the fall with Jan Beatty and Gita Katari. So I'm trying not to repeat what I read then, but I might end up doing them. I wanted to make two shout outs, one to Joan for this amazing new book. And you should buy it if you do not have it. It's called Fig Season. There's really a gorgeous, sexy, angry poem about Anna Magnani that I just love. I was reading it this afternoon. So you should buy this book. And the second shout out is to Michael Worser, who's a bit laid up. And I wanted to read a poem for him. I talked to him this afternoon. He said, what poem are you going to read? And I said, I'm going to read The British Detective, not remembering that there is no such poem. There's a book called The British Detective. And of course, you know, I've known Michael for so many years, always wondering how he writes those poems, and realizing then after that book came out that he is kind of like the British detective. He writes about Pittsburgh from this faraway place, like an outsider and a sleuth. But this is, you know, it's summer. This is a sexy little summer poem. So I thought I'd read this, The Picnic by Michael Worser. I was on a picnic with friends down by the river, and I saw a woman who resembled you in the water. She was waiting, and I wanted to be with her rather than with them. And I wanted to be with you rather than with her. Yes. There were the geese and ducks. The sun shone, and a breeze blew something that was like goose down from the trees. Lots of boats out on the water. And I wanted to be with you. Isn't that beautiful? So I'm moving around in the new and selected, and then I'll read some brand new poems. Every year, to me, Pride Month becomes more and more commercialized, and it is a celebration. It's urgent and essential, and it's wonderful. And every year I'm a little bit sadder. I think about my friends who were lost in that first wave of the AIDS pandemic. So this is an elegy called Poem at an Unmarked Grave. For my friend Jimmer, who was a brilliant young architecture student at Carnegie Mellon. Your grave is untouched by flowers I might have brought. You left me this fierce love of spaces. My newest memorial to you is a meadow garden holding stones of many shapes, mushroom, serpent, loaf of bread. You enter through the east and spiral through it till we come to two log chairs. It's stunning the way wind through the pines still can't make the sound of your voice. Every place is like every place. You'd laugh those nights we stayed enchanted till dawn at your drafting table, smoking and drawing boulevards and libraries. Your front windows above the glinting intersections were the eyes I used. The body of Pittsburgh curved under snow, sculpted finally into our dreams of it whole. The public domain of the universities and factories met the sturdy chimneys and streets of our privacy. We were 20 years old and lived inside Emerson's miracle. A college education is a room with a fire inside a strange city. A lot of my friends then couldn't wait to get out of Pittsburgh and move either to the East Coast or the West Coast. And this is for Gilbert, moving to New York. When you get there, walk into the Cafe Deutschland. Not the painting by Jörg Immendorf, but a bar I'm imagining. And the cold will leave you like a jacket dropped to the floor before a blazing fire, orange ceiling, blue walls, a green leather floor still warm from the women getting up to leave. Not on your account. They're off to another party. Order a drink, hot and strong. Everyone looks ready. Their clean hair and thick sweaters breathing at you. The paintings are amazing. A country scene folds in on itself forever. It's tiny scale, happy and intricate, like you. The night you left, you joined a long list of expatriates, all my old friends gone to California or East. Industry was dead 10 years ago, and our country of two classes, one called retrain, the other acquire, moves on, wobbly and mean. You stretch into a future, funneling canvases in from Germany, another country in need of a culture. The young expressionists want to meet you. They have. They're happy, they're painting and making money in small businesses and talking about where they buy their jeans, and they make good art. About your one worry, you'll survive as an organism in the big streets and small greeneries. The morning coffee tastes good as you ride up the elevator and when you ride down at night. The steel doors open, the great glass doors of the building hush closed, and you walk into the avenue, the city silver and black as your eyeglasses and coat. And I'll read this one for Mike. I'm happy to read Mike's been forever. It's from the Vietnam era, called The Ruined House. The ruined house above a meadow on a high lane, painted eggshell for years, went vacant and grayed, most of the windows gone. Cards and canteens, rusty cans and a camp cot in the attic open to sky. I counted 7. Every time I walked up there, 3 red spruce, 2 white pine, 2 hawthorn. I knew 6 boys, plus my brother, who'd been sent to Vietnam. The 7 trees rimmed the house and sang to it. Wind, snow squall, rain and resin, thorns and pips, all their tunes and tickings. The tar paper roof curled into a funnel made a crying sound. The township draft board protected their own. 7 trees were singing, lifting and turning, hiding me, going up there to scream. Sometimes you go away to write, you're lucky enough, somebody says, hey, use my space, you can have it for the week. And I get very excited and shit happens. Or it doesn't, I should say doesn't. Ars Poetica. Stalled and bitchy despite this lovely loft, mine for a week. Sitting, nothing. I try whistling, match the register of bird call from the high air shaft. I scrub, sweep, releasing the gleam of corners when suddenly the elevator whooshes. A kid 7 feet tall steps off and into my space, proffering a case of champagne. Quick glance and halt. Wrong, sorry. I nearly become a minor warehouse queen, a grace note, a locket, pomegranate intoxicating my desk. As I open the notebook, I've given up as too nice to use. Okay. I think I'll just move over to the new poems. I'll read a couple of those. Mm-hmm. there's an optical phenomenon. You can see it sometimes at the sea horizon at sunset. It's called the green ray. There's a short, not even a novella, it's a long short story maybe by Jules Verne by that name. And there's a really wonderful talk about it on YouTube by Tacita Dean. This poem is set in Amsterdam. There's a woman called the Roost Child who is the ghost of my Dutch grandmother. She shows up in the poem, and I think that's it. The green ray. Have I done enough besides counting the blue steel thistle flowers at my door and bowing to the Roost Child, 85, sightless, bent, cooling her pies on the sill? Have I visited Miro's Flemish imitations enough, his tender creams and bronzes, bright rubbed grays and scarlet pipings, loving him as much or more than Rembrandt? Hold that thought. I thread the canal belts and rings, running low on cash, soon returning across the North Sea to home. Walk the shoreline, tick through the fields of tulips, shiny warheads charting their 400 years of slaughter and indulgences, so I might see finally the day star's half-second stuff of miracles. Feeling younger, a needle sliding, no longer punching through surfaces in mud and gravel, I sit and wait. Have I delayed my strangeness, or have I been like the Roost Child's dream book, an open secret splayed on my table, spellbound by increments in the shapes of numbers or letters, holding my breath before sunset, the white hot disc, sky hovering, see it descending, buttering, watch it blink, close my eyes a second, lids hot canopies, helpless, shut to cool, wait, open and see, wait for it. Blue sea and lemon star fused, flare to vapor, and there, a heartless green, a bitter lime, a freezer burnt chartreuse tongue, swollen and seething horizontally atop the sea. What is about to leave our lives at brutal speed? Lathing my eyeballs softer now. See it once, you just about have it. Or think you see it and you burnish yourself to a gold flame later in the telling. Telling of it, your whole life, thrill undimmed. Last poem, The Little Fox. During the 50s, my mother and her sister both wore those little fur pieces around their necks. Little fox, brass clamp gripping your mouth to tail. Lovely your red blend fur against her chestnut chignon. Your bright shining eyes watched me while her neck turned and she dipped to hug me before the nightclub hours. You must have danced and twirled, her head spinning, unless the lights were too hot and she rested you on the back of a leather banquette. Everyone admired you lounging, perfumed with whiskey and smoke. My poor idea of a woodland escape, running past fires, blazing streams, rushing. I've thought of returning to you so many times, unburying you, even if the banks of Sulphur Creek restored, fresh with wild cherry and willow, might feel familiar to you. Even if the sharp triangles of your perfect ears or the thread claws of your feet or wet black eyes are chewed to dust. I should have carried you to the cremation shrine and brought your ashes home instead of laying you down in the grass alone, snout facing cold east, tail unfurled west to the brutal Ohio. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Thank you, Judy. Mike Schneider began writing during the Vietnam War when serving at an Air Force base in Ohio. He published an anti-war underground newspaper. He has practiced law, worked as a science writer, won awards for magazine writing, book reviews, essays on culture, and three times nominated for Pushcart. He has three chapbooks have come out most recently. He was awarded second prize in Ireland for the Poets Meets Politics International Open in 2022. It is really great to have him reading from his full-length collection, Spring Mills, published by Ragged Sky Press, 2023. Please welcome Mike Schneider.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you. Is that working okay? Yeah. Up a little? Okay.
Raise that up. Oh, can you stand there? Gotcha.
That should be about right. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be sharing time with you all and to be able to read on a bill with Deborah and with Judy. And so I shall begin. Joan mentioned my book, Spring Mills, came out this year. Spring Mills is a very small town in central Pennsylvania, almost like smack dab in the middle of the state. There might be 500 people living there. My father grew up there. And I'm going to read from the title poem, Spring Mills, which is dated Memorial Day, 1943, pardon me, it'll help. And at 17, my father had a silver cornet and blue light stirred behind his eyes. He stepped out behind the slide trombones, march tempo, six abreast. Six pair of spats, sparkling white on spit shine, Sunday shoes, row on row of legs, draped in royal blue, striped with gold, 120 steps a minute to the rattle of the snare down Main Street. The music is proud, Sousa, and my father swells with breath beneath brass buttons, mouthpiece pressed to lips, triple tonguing, double forte, bright notes burst into the air of crystalline afternoon, lilac-scented spring. In from the fields on holiday, a corridor of eyes and smiles, calloused hands clapping as the band steps by. These kids sound good, don't they? His silver horn sings out legato over Penns Creek, where it curves, under the wobbly footbridge by the fire hall. Stars and stripes ripple from the flagpole at the post office. An old willow leans over the water, strand after strand of green tears. A red-winged blackbird screeches, lifts into the breeze, epaulets splashing scarlet as it flaps across the creek to the ball field like a young man crossing the sea to war. Also from Spring Mills, this is called The Trouble with Love. The trouble with love, says a friend of mine, is you give it an inch, it takes you dancing, takes you to lunch and the cleaners, takes you where your mother said, don't go, and your father went and came home begging forgiveness. The trouble with love is ice cracks, earth howls when love arrives, like a crocus in spring, if it could cry with joy as it heaves toward light, open the windows. Love is the best drug there is. The trouble with love is hit the road, Jack. You're an empty sack. To be alive is to lose the world like Bonaparte alone on that high shelf of the fire escape where you look down at your feet and think the trouble with love is a wild white flag deer in a distant snowfield, flashing, gone, bloodhound sniffing a scorched trail into the tangled heartland where there is no trail, blue hole in a cold blue sky under a flat stone. You find a note you once wrote to yourself that says, the trouble with love. I have another book almost ready to go. It's called About Time. And oh yes, this is a supermarket in Pittsburgh. So many of you know a famous poem by Allen Ginsberg, pretty famous as poems go, called A Supermarket in California, and has Walt Whitman appear as Allen Ginsberg, the first person is wandering through the aisles of the grocery store. A supermarket in Pittsburgh. My pirate's hat with the big yellow P on top stands today for pissed off, petulant poet, me, in mirror-tinted dark glasses, searching up and down the aisles for seltzer water and extra firm tofu, absorbed in my tired spirit, dodging every familiar face, my neighbor, the amiable racist, my ex-wife's best friend, our lady of the benevolent smile. Where are you today, Walt Whitman? Lonely, graybeard, wordmonger, courage, teacher, made of only in America grit and nourishing green fiber. I'm a pair of ragged claws, scuttling toward the take a number, please, dispenser to take a stand for ham, thin sliced, shaved and shriveled into grease spots on butcher's paper. I'm ready for checkout and want my last rites to be a taste of these strawberries and those tomatoes. Vine ripened, says the sign, actually smell like tomatoes, like my mother's garden, August, fiery red fat slices on fresh bread, with pepper, black flakes from a grinder, acrid, dark from the earth, sweet tarragon, mustard, a smear of horseradish. Life, you have your moments. I'll give you that as I savor this imaginary sandwich. But please don't ask me to talk with anyone until I've chewed and swallowed every bite. I often find myself writing about music one way or another. So a little pop quiz. Dan always accuses, my friend Jan Hamilton always accuses me of doing pop quizzes. Who knows who Wilhelm Furtwängler was? A couple. One, two, a few hands.
Thanks, Manson.
Yeah. That's all right. I'll tell you. Okay, good one, Jay. Yes, he was conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic during the lead up and through World War II into the 1950s. He was controversial because he stayed and didn't leave, like many artists and famous people in Germany did, who could, and he could have, and he, many people felt he allowed himself to be used by the Third Reich because he basically toured around Europe leading the orchestra. But there's also this side of Kurt Wagner, from a man whose name sounds like a sausage machine. You don't expect greatness. Kurt Wagner might be a cast iron food grinder with an oak handled crank. Maybe you'd find one in Munich, 1933, a beer hall teeming with noisy men in brush mustaches, lederhosen, and Tyrolean hats like Chico Marx wore. In doorways and at long tables on benches, they're hoisting steins and singing about someone named Horst. The Horst Wessel song is a Nazi song. The day will come for revenge. No forgiveness, they roar, when Heil and Sieg will ring through the fatherland. Kurt Wagner, lanky and long in a tie and dark suit, too big for him, arms waving like a huge bird whose wings lift on spiritual light and set orchestras on fire with music. Can you, with what you know, imagine what he felt that day, 1935, tapping his baton for the Berlin Phil, as if to say, ready, let's play Beethoven on my downbeat. And he'd raised no salute of any kind, meets for you know who in front beside Goebbels, while everyone stood and hailed Kurt Wagner. To me now, he's like a cowboy or gangster in a movie, whipping in the face of death, but it was real. I have a 4th of July poem here. Here it is. It's called July 5th. This is the holiday coming up. My grandfather named Harry, when I was young and he was around the house a lot, every year as the 4th of July was coming around, he had this saying, which I've never heard from anyone else. He who goes forth with a fifth on the fourth may not come forth on the fifth. Very poetic. Free espresso Monday is one way to crank the starter of happily lazy neurons. Morning after the fourth, last night's thunder still ringing the anvil of my inner ear, burnt powder tingle in the nostrils. Red zephyrs to the stars and cascades of jade crystal, as if from the hand of a god who can't sleep and wanders into the kitchen of the oldest part of night to make a sandwich. Such is the movie in my mind as afternoon arrives and shadows jitter the floor of Daniel Boone's forest, Jeff's cabin, Kentucky wind through leafy arms of copper beech. White oak, yellow poplar, black squirrel tails twitch into question marks as acorn bombs rattle the grooved tin roof, a ruby flash of minuscule pterodactyl at the nectar dispenser. Helicopters of birdland, my friend Trudy called them, seventh grade, her biology paper that made her famous in a pleasantly Ohio small pond way. I too hover at the feeder, listen, purple scratch marks scatter from my uniball microvision.
Oh boy.
My friend Jan Hamilton, who's seated right here, we visited Prague for about 10 days or so, a few years ago now. And so we learned some things about what many of us know as the Velvet Revolution, and it's called the Velvet Revolution, yes, in part because it was less violent than many other revolutions, but the main reason the Czechs call it the Velvet Revolution is because there was a rock band called the Velvet Underground from New York City that was the model for a group of musicians in Prague at that time called Plastic People of the Universe. I'm not making this up. And what triggered the ultimate takedown of the Soviet regime was this group of kids, Plastic People of the Universe, who were mainly the children of middle class and bourgeois citizens of Prague, had rock music parties. Rock music was illegal. It seems amazing, but it was even illegal to own Beatle records. It was contraband material. You could go to jail for having rock music in your apartment. And so these kids were arrested and went to jail, and then people started protesting, and that was really the large part of the momentum. So this for the overturning of the Soviet government. This is called Plastic People, Velvet Prague. It's a Dada tribute. It's a very Dada poem. You'll hear to Vaclav Havel and Tom Stoppard's rock and roll. Tom Stoppard grew up in Prague, and his play Rock and Roll depicts some of that era when the revolution was happening. A lot of background here. Plastic People of the Universe, one of their songs had a refrain. I'm not making this up either. It goes, peace. Piece of toilet paper. So I borrowed that for this poem. Red velvet cake in South Carolina is an almost sickly sweet way to say rebellion. Velvet on the antlers of white-tailed deer is a growth hormone. Bluer than velvet is the night, sings Bobby Vinton, when I'm in high school and Jessica in a night blue velvet dress shows me how to slow dance. The Velvet Underground in New York City with John Cale's viola on Sweet Jane is the dive bomb scream of a Stuka, 250 kilograms of heaven-sent oblivion. Submit, says the Wehrmacht, or welcome your velvet bells. Shiny, shiny boots of leather. Imagine there's no heaven, sings John Lennon. There is no heaven, says the other Lenin. In Prague, Plastic People of the Universe say peace, piece of toilet paper. In Soviet Prague, toilet paper is recycled, single ply, unbleached brown. Dialecticians of ideology produce slogans on posters that are like velvet ropes to guide us into the good buddy club of the proletariat. Workers unite for peace and freedom, nice slogan. People tend to pretend lies are true and to feel that to exist is better than not to. One stubborn grocer, one awakened spirit will do, says Havel, to refuse pretense. People start to know themselves again. John Lennon is acquainted with the touch of a velvet hand like a lizard on a window pane. The other Lennon likes to kiss with an iron fist in a velvet glove. In Prague, Plastic People of the Universe say peace, piece of toilet paper. Meanwhile, capitalist toilet paper is two-ply, white and soft almost as velvet lips that kissed me into light. Black velvet drapes five horses harnessed in gold trappings to the hearse of the Winter King, Henry VII, who with spies and meticulous parchment keeps score on the velvet-clad merchants and nobles he holds up for loot with rigged courts and clammy cells. History, river of time and strange fortune, carries Marx to Prague. Injustice is a social disease. Nice slogan. Velveeta cheese rhymes with please. Plastic people of the universe say peace. Piece of toilet paper. Let's have a wedding, says Magor of the plastic people. The parasites and hooligans will come. That's what they were arrested for, being parasites and hooligans. love, says Zappa. They loved Zappa in the Eastern Bloc even more than most of the other American rock musicians, because Zappa had no pretense about what lefty communist totalitarianism was about, and often spoke about it. Love, says Zappa, will never be a product of plasticity. Show me someone not a parasite, and I'll say a prayer for him, says Zimmerman. The wedding march goes through a tunnel of velvet truncheons, velvet student blood flows. Imagine all the people, says John Lennon, exhausted with exhaustion, tired of being tired. Bureaucracy is shit, says the other Lennon, afraid of old people who remember, and young people with typewriters. From trial and jail in Prague, plastic people of the universe say, peace, piece of toilet paper. Good King Wenceslas went out, and from the grand iron-railed balcony of what's now Marks and Spencer's department store, no relation to Carl or Herbert, in Prague's grandest public square, Pavel, released from Ruzyn prison and pneumonia, shakes and rattles his car keys for a couple hundred thousand Czechs and Slovaks, after which Salgovic, Ubina, Kolder, Indra, and Bilak of the Politburo scamper like mice to Moscow, done with Dada pranksters who play Zappa and velvet-flavored rock and roll. Thank you, Elvis, says John Lennon, to the king of musical revolution, his face always easy to find, hand painted on black velvet. Help, I need somebody else, says the other Lennon, too late in Prague. Plastic people of the universe say peace, piece of toilet paper.
That was fun. Okay.
Things are. My most recent poems are in a chapel called Many Hats. All these poems are hats like bowler, pork pie, soap pipe, pillbox, beret, fedora, things like that. So I'm going to read one of these I hadn't planned on reading, but I'm inspired by Judy's poem about the fox skull. And this is for my grandmother, whose name was Nona, and it's called Trapper. My grandparents, my mother's parents, were fluent in German. I loved how those furry flaps flipped down and chin strapped warmed my ears. Trapper's is the kind of hat that has those flaps on it. Maybe it was rabbit fur, the real thing, as Grandma Nona said, from a German hare, same big-eared bunny, Albrecht Dürer, rendered with nearly scientific whiskered strokes of rabbitness. In art books, if you look closely, its nose twitches, and you hear, what's up, Doc, from those quasi-rabbit Looney Tunes. Among small mammals, Nona favored fox, like the red fur in her bedroom closet. When Harry wouldn't shut up about Stuttgart after the war, which was often She'd drape that ghastly russet orange pelt across her shoulders, flap its tail, and waltz about, two-headed, one with a vulpine snout, fervid eyes, a face that might any minute flash, gleaming incisors, and breach the nearest hen house. In that freaky stole, she'd become bewitching high bourgeois Frau Detweiler. "Guten Tag, Herr Schneider," she'd say to me. "Sprechen Sie?" "Nein," that was all I knew to say. "Nein, Fräulein," an answer to which she'd object. "Ich bin kein Fräulein, ich bin ein Frau." Hardly at all did I appreciate why that mattered as much as it did. She was reminding us, reminding herself that she was a married woman. And well, that meant a lot, especially in Germany in that period of time. Okay, I'm going to close with Boston Jack. Boston Jack is a kind of hat, dark felt, you could call Celtic Stetson, useful to cover your noggin, as your mother, if she was like mine, said once or twice as she stepped out the door. Where was I going? January, God's icy breath smacked my face, frigid air chewed the rim of my ears. To deliver the news, good and bad, in print, still warm from the press, to the hardy people of Main Street, my hometown, to respectfully knock on doors and say, collecting, to drop coins into my drawstring sack and jangle them, silver half dollars with Ben Franklin in bas relief profile, noble George Washington quarters, Liberty dimes, Buffalo nickels, Abe Lincoln shiny copper pennies. I'd count and pack them into wrappers, proudly forming hot dog shaped cylinders of heavy metal. I'd lift and hold in my rolled up young fist as if to make thunder and lightning like Thor, money, mine, to take downtown and deposit at Farmers National Bank. People called this growing up. It was bound to happen. It takes a village. You need a hat. Thank you.
Stay there.
So again, thanks to White Whale. Thanks to our amazing poets. What an evening of poetry. And this evening is being recorded and it will be available soon on the Hemingway Summer Poetry a blog, so you can listen and hear these poems again. And there's 11 years on that of archive on that blog. So good opportunity to hear what's been, you know, what, I mean, there's an amazing, it's an amazing archive. I mean, we're just so lucky to have it. I'm going to read one poem by Jimmy Savetic, whom, as you remember, was a Vietnam veteran and an Allegheny County uniformed officer, an undercover officer, a homicide detective, and was really involved with helping young men and women find another, you know, find some purpose that might really help them for the rest of their lives. And he did that through teaching them boxing. And that work still goes on. And he really believed that there was no such thing as a bad boy or a bad child. He really believed in redemption. And and that was probably because his own youth was rather rough and colorful. The poem I'm going to read is called Just Because. I know there are things that you ain't supposed to do and will probably get a good whipping if you're caught, but you'll do them anyway, just because. And for no other reason than just because. Like, you ain't supposed to play with matches just because you can burn someone's porch down or shoot marbles with a slingshot at a dog just because you ain't. And you ain't supposed to tie two cats' tails together and toss them over a clothesline. And you ain't supposed to fart in church. And you ain't supposed to rob the poor box. You ain't supposed to stick anyone in the eye with an umbrella. And you ain't supposed to make pipe bombs because you might blow your fingers off. And you ain't supposed to stick bubble gum in anyone's hair or put crazy glue on toilet seats or flush cherry bombs down the toilet. And you ain't supposed to tell lies. But if you have to tell a lie, do it boldface. Do it and make sure it's a damn good one. And if you get caught red-handed, tell another. And make sure your head is hung down and mumble like you're really sorry, even though you ain't. And you ain't supposed to swear unless you like eating soap. And you ain't supposed to hit your mother because you will die. When you die, your hand will come out of the grave and a dog will pee on it. And you ain't supposed to tell your sister to swallow a whole fizzy like it's a communion wafer, because if she does, her belly will swell like she's going to have a baby and resemble like Mount Vesuvius, and purple stuff will come out of her nose because she'll cry while crying, blaming you for sure. And if you hide in a tree, your mom will find you and you'll catch the switch. But it is something to watch your mom climb a tree with a stick in her mouth when she's mad. And you ain't supposed to go swimming butt ass in the river because you might drown and get eaten by the fish. And you ain't supposed to throw anyone's tennies in the toilet. You ain't supposed to play hook from school and go downtown to shoplift. You ain't supposed to steal cars or catch rats or and put them in anyone's locker. And you ain't supposed to sass or mimic or put your palm on a bus and have a pretty girl sit on your hand, because she will sure enough get mad and think you goosed her and tattle, and nothing good will ever come of it when somebody tattles you for a goosing. And you ain't supposed to play tricks out on people, like take their bag of potato chips or their apple, because then you'll have to pretend to like them even when you don't. And they will for sure want to hang around with you all day. You'll have to douse them with skunk perfume. And sure as gosh awful will be found out because of a little crybaby telling. And you ain't ever supposed to find fun in kicking a pigeon. If you're caught, you'll get the blame for stuff you didn't do, even if you blame your brother. Anyway, I know boys that never part their hair or wash their hands, that lie and swear and smell like the alley and do fun things like that. And they weren't really bad boys, maybe just a little mischievous, but they weren't bad. And to tell you the truth, I think some of these things defined a boy as a man. And sure as all hell, as all sin follows forgiveness, you ain't ever to look at a girl's behind when in church because you could go blind. And because some things you ain't supposed to do just because, but you do them anyway, just because. And there's no other explanation other than just because. And there's a good possibility you could one day grow up and become the president. So look forward very much to seeing you all and you folks in Zoom land who might want to try to come out here too. Because it won't be raining in 2 weeks, I almost promise it. And our readers will be Chandra Alderman, Kevin Finn, Matthew Yusia, Bart Solarchik. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Chris, for hosting, making all this and that great intro. And thank you all for being here. You know, there are books for sale. Did anybody mention that? There are books for sale. There's some wonderful books by these poets and a whole lot of other books. Thank you to White Whale. See you in 2 weeks.